All right, so part two with Scott Olsen. So let's just recap just a little bit from this story. So we go through Scott's growing up, and then after growing up, he goes is a extremely lucrative lawyer in a multiplicity of ways, starts a hedge fund, does really well at the start of the hedge fund, finds Jesus. The 2008 financial crisis really put a damper on the hedge fund. They sold the hedge fund in 2010. So after he sold the hedge fund, that's where we're going to get. So in 2010, you guys sold this hedge fund, okay? So you told me how you sold, why you sold the hedge fund. Number one, your heart wasn't in it. Number two, you were trying to just, you were honestly getting out because you did well. So 07, 08, 09 happened. It just kind of knocked your knees out from under you. Financially, when you sold this thing, were you great financially because you had done well? Like, where were you at financially at this stage?
I was probably aware that if I didn't really want to work again, I probably didn't have to. And in fact, you know, after that, I had started some businesses. I joined this firm called Turtle Creek Holdings.
Yep. Before you sold?
Right after I sold.
Okay.
And then, you know, from there we were making investments, but honestly, my heart was just not in it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's when I kind of really made a pivot into probably more full-time ministry at that
okay.
point in time.
So you said you took a break for 5 years.
Yeah, it was during that time.
But before that, You joined a family office.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that is a term that only like, you know, quote, I hate to say this word, rich, wealthy people do. So a friend of mine sold his company. I think he made really, really well.
Yep.
He, quote unquote, started a family office.
Yeah.
So what is, in layman's terms, what do you, when you start a family office, what does that look like?
Well, there's a bunch of different types of family offices
okay.
without getting complicated. You can have what they call a single family office where you've just made so much money that you've got enough money to where you can hire a staff of 10 people or investment professionals and assistants and accountants and tax people. And all they do is work on helping you invest the money you've made. And there's, I don't know what the starting figure is. That's probably the several billion, I would think, if you really want to do it right.
Okay.
There's also what they call multifamily offices, which is where there's multiple families, right? So they pool their money together so that they have those 10 people that do all the investing and tax and accounting.
So the Coxes, the Olsons, the Pettises, the Hodges,
exactly.
the Smiths, the Jones,
yep,
the whatever.
Right. All collectively come together and say, hey, we'll pool our assets. We'll collectively pay for these people
kinda
and we'll make investments.
Kind of like a hedge fund.
Kind of like a hedge fund. In fact, family offices today, multifamily offices and single family offices, has really become the new hedge fund.
Okay. I did not know that.
Yeah. So you're really just collectively pooling your money to build a back office and then go out and invest in buy businesses, invest in businesses, manage your capital.
I thought that may be kind of what it is, but you just explained it really, really well. So you joined a family office.
That's right.
Is this the Turtle Creek Holdings?
That's right. Yep.
Can't find it anywhere on the internet.
No.
It ain't on the internet,
no.
y'all. Don't even look. It ain't on there. So I looked it up, couldn't find anything. So you took your money and you put it in this family office and said, hey, here you go, guys. Did you take like all of your money?
Yeah, I mean, most everything. And the way you do it, and for the most part, you're not like contributing it in. It's like, you know, you're working together to support the back office. And if you want to do a deal, you do it together, basically. So you just use your capital to invest into structures. It's really a partnership. It's really a partnership.
It's like starting another company.
Exactly. It's like a partnership that just collectively supports the back office.
Okay, so say, okay, let's just use this for example. Say the Coxes, the Pettises, the Hodges, and the Olsons all started a family office.
That'd be a really good one.
That'd be a great one. So if we all started a family office, would we need to pool the same amount of capital in order?
No.
Okay.
No. In fact, it was completely imbalanced. Like one of my partners, the Beckman family, and Dan Beckman, he's got lots more money than I do. So it's not that. It's just you just have to be willing to carry the back office. And
what does that mean, carry
office.
The back office?
Well, because people cost money, right? So you need an accountant, you need a tax person, you need a secretary, you need some investment professionals, you need some analysts. All that collectively adds up to, what, $2 million a year? So you can either write $2 million a year.
I was not going to say that
right?
much, but that's a lot. But
well,
okay, yeah.
It depends on what
Yeah, it depends on who
in.
They are.
If
yeah,
you're
sure.
In Dallas, I mean, you know, try to get a, you know, people and make a lot of money.
And those people just manage your money. Just
right.
just take care of your collective family. Your
that's
collective
right.
family.
That's right.
What is it called? Family office.
That's right. That's right.
And so they're your people. I think I know a guy here
that's
in
right.
town that does that.
Oh, there's a lot of them here that do that.
So this is funny you say this. So there's a guy here that was a gigantic in Birmingham. There's a gigantic multifamily guy, and there's I'll just say the first name. There's a guy named Brian that worked at his place in Michigan.
Okay.
His financial services place in Morgan Stanley or something there. Yeah. And he was helping manage the money for this particular guy here in Birmingham.
Yep.
Brian then moves to Birmingham to help manage said guy's money.
That's exactly right. And he probably hired a team around.
So this guy that this big player guy that I don't want to mention his name is he hired Brian to manage. So he probably hired Brian to be in his family office.
That's right. Maybe even lead
it. That's what he did.
Maybe even lead his family office.
Okay. That starts all the pieces.
And it kind of depends on like what your investment strategy is. Right, some people that have a family office are very diverse. Some are very focused on what they do. Some are investing in companies. Some are investing in the public stock market. So the team you build is going to be representative of how you invest.
Of how you want to invest. So there's people that just – there would be a team that would just focus on multifamily or people that on oil and gas or people whatever.
And the bigger you get, the more diversified that gets.
You need to get.
Michael Bloomberg probably has 150 people that work in his family office. I mean, you know.
Okay. So even
maybe more. Michael Dell, he probably has 200 people that work in his family office,
and they just take all the assets and whatever
they manage
and
them. Yeah, I mean some family offices are so big today they have their own hedge funds inside the family offices.
Really?
Oh yeah, you know.
Okay, what about these people? So you mentioned the Middle East. I got another question here, but I want to ask this. So you mentioned the Middle East and the severity of wealth.
Oh man,
that some of these places have. Is mind-blowing to probably everyone in America. They make people like the Warren Buffetts of the world look small.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not the one human being that has this money. It's the family.
Yeah.
And the family, the sultan of whoever, like those people have just unforeseen amounts of money that they have access to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if all those guys were reported, they'd blow up the Forbes list. I mean, you know, everybody that's on the current Forbes list would be replaced
because of those guys.
Oh.
What is that, Scott? Where does all that like wealth come from? Is it wisdom? Is it just luck of the draw? Is it lucky sperm? Like what is it?
It's lucky sperm for the most part because it's all mainly oil and gas. If you're talking about the Saudi Arabias of the world, right? I mean, the ruling families and the hundreds of offshoots from the ruling family are still obviously making all their money off of what's in the ground. I mean, they own everything. They own all the land. They own what's under the land. So
they own how to get it out of the land.
They own everything, you know. So they're just making literally hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it's in fact, I was just in Dubai, and I've been doing business in the Middle East a long time. I have a great family over there called the Cotton family that's been my local partner for 14 years.
Wow.
And I was just in Dubai, and I – got the opportunity to go with one of the sheikhs to see this new...
What's a sheikh?
One of the royal family members.
Gotcha.
To go see one of the new developments that they were building, condo projects. And it was along this canal that runs out into the ocean. And it was it's a beautiful city if you've never been, but it was an interesting area because it's the one area in this kind of cool area where if you're not from UAE, you can actually own property, which supposedly makes it more valuable. So I'm doing this tour and I'm asking him, you know, talking to him about it. And he has this lady come over to help us, you know, with some of the pricing. They're starting at like $38 million for a 2-bedroom going up to $150 million. So I'm looking at him.
For a 2-bedroom.
Yeah. And I'm looking at him like, where in the world is all this money coming from? And it's just money that's really not in the system. It's like Ukraine. Like a ton of money coming out of Ukraine right now, a ton of money coming out of Russia right now, a ton of money coming out of all the old Soviet states.
Do you think all that money is like, is it not reported?
Not reported.
But when you say not reported, it's just like old blue-haired money.
Well, I mean, listen, we got to be careful here.
Yeah, sure.
We're going to fall into the political world if we're not careful. But
there's no, you've already mentioned Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah,
UAE.
It's kind of funny. I mean, we won't belabor this topic, but I was over there with a friend of mine that I've known for a very long time who's a real estate developer in Dubai, and I said, we got to tell him his name. I won't mention his name.
Yeah.
But I said, where is all this coming from? He said, from America. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, well, all the money you send to Ukraine, they spend it here.
Oh.
And I said, well, okay.
You got us. So you got the family office, and after you sold the hedge fund, you you went into ministry.
Yeah.
For tell me about going into ministry and what that looks like.
So when I was at a really, really low point in my life after Bruce had went to prison, and you know, I was trying again just to kind of figure things out. I mean, because you got to remember, I had just become a believer.
Mm.
One of the most godly men I've ever met in my life is now going to jail. I was sitting there trying to figure out, like, okay, Jesus, where are you in all of this? Like, if you're so good, why am I in such a weird spot here? Like, why do I feel so bad about all of this? So I was really struggling. I mean, really struggling.
Sure.
And I met a guy in the midst of this, a guy named Albert Huddleston, who's a great man and just was so wonderful to me, introduced me to a guy named Mike Fetchner. And we were having breakfast one morning and with Albert, and he's like, Scott, I want you to help a friend of mine with a project he's got in West Dallas. And he said his name's Mike Fetchner. So he introduces me to Mike, and I get a phone call from Mike. And I just remember we're talking on the phone. At the end of the call, he prayed for me. And I just remember hanging up thinking, I never had anybody pray for me on the first introductory call that's, quote, a business guy. So anyway, fast forward a couple of months later, and on a day that I was having a pretty miserable day, I get a phone call from Mike that just, I mean, God orchestrated that phone call. And he said, Scott, God put you on my heart today, and would you come and have, you know, lunch with me? And I'm like, okay. So that lunch turned into 5 or 6
Don't
hours.
Be Jesus guilt to me.
Oh my gosh. We sat there for like 6 hours.
Wow.
And Mike, it's interesting because Mike had been a business guy turned pastor turned founder of an inner city ministry called Bridge Builders that turned into Bonfire Farms. But here's what's really crazy about it. Literally when I met him, he had just been diagnosed with stage 4 non-smoker's lung cancer and given about 9 months to live. And so I'm finding all of this out. He's finding out about everything I did. And if you did a search for Mike Fetchner, you would see that this is a legend of the faith. And you know, everybody around the globe knows about Mike Fetchner. But at that time, you know, Mike was just inside of a little, you know, ministry in Bonfire. And he became my mentor. He became my brother and my spiritual dad to a large degree. So for the next 5 years, that 9 months turned into 5 years.
Oh, man.
So for the next 5 years, I really, you know, just followed Mike around. I mean, I did ministry in the inner city. I did, you know, hospital visits. I prayer walked streets. I went to Bible studies. And he introduced me to church. Like he was going to a church in Dallas called Prestonwood, and he was speaking one night. And I remember he said, hey, come on. So Saturday night I'm speaking, you and Aaron come. So we came, and I remember at the end of it, you know, he was standing there, I was having an altar call. And I remember walking down there just because I wanted to hug his neck.
Yeah.
And it was just such a big thing for me to step out.
Sure.
One of the first times I'd ever been in a church, really.
Really?
And so he had invited us there. And then we just started going to Prestonwood because Mike was there. And obviously that changed our whole life in a lot of different ways. But yeah, Mike was the guy that kind of pulled me into, like, and it really wasn't even planned. It just
started. But you wanted to go into ministry. That's the weird, like, you sell the hedge fund and you want to go into ministry and you didn't know this guy. So like, was it just like, I need to sell this hedge fund and I need to work for Jesus. Is that what's the thought?
No. Like, I didn't really even know I wanted to go into ministry, really.
Yeah.
Like, it just kind of happened.
Sure.
Like, I wasn't working.
You weren't working, and you met this guy, and he started to be your, you have nothing to do. It didn't sound
I didn't
like.
Have anything to do. I'd take walks with Aaron in the morning, and rest of the day I'd just go. I'd hang out at the church. I'd hang out with Mike. That's how I met all the pastors at the church, because I'd just sit there, and they just introduced themselves, and just became friends with everybody, really.
So, okay, let's talk technically now. You've got 3 kids at this time. This is 2010. Yeah, 2010. You got 3 kids at the time.
Yep.
So, how are you paying your bills?
Like, well, I just had a lot of money that I'd made.
The family office.
Yeah, and I just,
is that making money?
It is, and I'd had money that I just had from when I sold the hedge fund.
You sold the hedge fund.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't make money for like 5 years.
Yeah, but did the family office make? Don't
yeah,
is it
yeah.
that like what family
oh, yeah.
offices do?
Oh, yeah.
So you pay it. You in essence pay dues because you got to pay the people. But then they manage the money, and so you have money coming in.
We still have great investments that are still producing cash from that now.
In that right
even
now,
still.
Yeah. Gotcha. What's harder, making money or managing money?
Managing money, I would say. I
Why?
Mean, it just depends on who you are, I guess.
Why you? Do you? From you?
From me, from my standpoint, I don't know. Making money to me has always kind of come natural a little bit. I mean, managing money is less exciting to me, I guess, maybe.
Yes, that's for sure.
The making money, I guess because I just put more effort into making it than I do managing it.
I'm trying to think how to ask this question. The spiritual DNA that you have now, as opposed to what you had probably the first, I don't know, 30 or 40 years of your life, the spiritual DNA that you have now, do you think that had you had that through your 30s, 20s and 30s, things would have been different?
Yeah, totally. I do. I don't know if I could have been as hard charging as I was. I think I'd have had a ton of people in my life saying, you got to be a better father, and you got to be a better husband, and you need to take time out for things like that. And I just don't think I could have achieved what I achieved. I mean, God can do anything, so I can play that game. But, you know, and also, I mean, it's an ugly world. I mean, like, I don't really like to be around sinful circumstances.
Well, the Bible's pretty clear,
you know,
on, you know, being equally yoked and just,
I don't want to go someplace where everybody's drunk and cussing.
No, yeah, I agree.
You know, I just kind of stay away from places like that.
Yeah.
Well, in my old world,
that was what it was.
Not a regular occurrence. I mean, you didn't have dinner where that wasn't happening, right? I mean, so it would have just been hard for my stomach. I'd have had to have a different mentality, I guess. It would have been more of a missional, you know, mentality.
So all of this stuff, I'm at 2010, go to 2015. All of this is in Dallas.
All of this is in Dallas. Everything from when I started my practice until then.
Where's Erin from?
She was born in actually Guam, raised in Boston, went to high school in Los Angeles area, and moved to Dallas after college.
So you met her in Dallas?
Yes.
Okay. So you're in Dallas all these years. So we're 2010, you're 54, 10 years. So you're born in 1970. You're born in 1970. So you moved to, when did you move to Birmingham?
2018.
So you moved to Birmingham in 2018. Why? Okay, let's go back. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I didn't even get a chance to answer. So 2010 to 2005, you took off. What did you do after you had done the ministry thing for 5 years? What did you start doing then?
So ministry took a lot of paths for me. I got a lot of great opportunities. But one of the things that I did is my pastor at the time, Pastor Graham, Jack Graham, they had come to me and asked me to start a Bible fellowship class. And, you know, it's like a Sunday school.
Yeah,
class,
sure.
Right?
Not many people know what Sunday school is. Yeah. So I have a confession to make. Can I make this right quick before you get on this story?
Sure.
So my mom is 76 and plays organ in the Baptist church to this day. Okay. I was in church 9 months before I was born. Okay. I went to Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. Went to Sunday school. I'm 44 years old. I'm in the car yesterday with a friend of mine, Jeremy Tuggle, who's a saint, and his two boys and my son. And Jeremy says, I teach the Sunday school class to sixth graders. And Tegan goes, what's that?
There you go, see? That's out lost.
And I had to explain to my son what Sunday school was, because it's just not a thing in a non-Baptist church.
That's right. It's not a thing.
So, I'm sorry.
No.
I had confession time.
And we make it even worse. We call it Bible fellowship.
Yeah,
exactly. We call it Sunday school. That's the modern term.
So you start Sunday school.
I did. Started Sunday school class. But what's really cool about it, and I'll try to make this short, but so we had started going to church, and it was on a Saturday night, and, you know, we were sitting on the second row, and there's a whole story to how we got to the second row. But, you know, in the time where the pastor always say, get up and greet three or four people around you, I always met this couple, Francis and Bill Dickerson. They were an older couple. And eventually it said, hey, what if we get together and have coffee sometime? And so I started meeting them outside church. And one day we're having coffee at their house, and I'm praying for them and just ministering to them. And we're still close friends to this day, by the way. And Francis looks at me and she says, Scott, I'm so glad we met you. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she said, well, I've just always worried that if we ever died, nobody would even know we were dead. And I said, Francis, how long have you been at Prestonwood? She said, we've been there about 11 years. I said, you've been there 11 years sitting on the third row, and nobody knows you well enough to know whether or not you were dead or alive. And it just blew me away. So I went back. About this time is when I was asked to start this Sunday school class. Mm-hmm. And I went back and I told him, I said, listen, I'll do it. With one condition. I want to call it the pastor's class, and I want all the pastors in the church to rotate through and teach that class to get to know the people in my class, people like Francis and Bill Dickerson. And I went to Pastor Graham, and I said, Jack, I want you to teach it also. So he agreed to do it once a year. In fact, that was a great event we had every year that he came to my class. So we started it with just a rotation of pastors. And finally, we ran out of the pastors. Everybody got tired of it. And I started bringing in church planters, because I had helped start the church planting ministry at Preston. Was we started bringing in church planters, and then I started bringing in missionaries.
Right.
And I would fly them all to Birmingham or to Dallas at the time, and let, you know, put them up and give their family a good time. They'd come.
How
talk
big
to
is
my
this class?
So it started out, and it was me and my wife and two couples. So it was about eight of us in my living room because we weren't big enough to have a room at the church.
Oh yet. Yeah.
Because it's a big church. Preston was the biggest Baptist church in the nation, I think, still. And so we started out in my house, and then it outgrew that, and they gave us a room, and it kept growing, it kept growing, it kept growing, it kept growing. Eventually, I think we had over 200 people on our register, and we'd have 100 people every, and we did it on Saturday nights. And what's really cool about that class, and this kind of speaks to my heart, like, you know, I've always enjoyed ministering to kind of the down and out.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's probably because of my
The way you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up. I just always have a heart for somebody that has potential but just doesn't even know it, you know, and just struggle for whatever reason. So we started the class, and it became a class of kind of misfits. Anybody that didn't fit into the upper Plano middle class, they'd come to my class.
Go to Scott's class.
Exactly. They would, and it just grew. And then I started, and this is going to lead in, I'm going to answer your question. Then I started getting to know this ministry in the inner city called the Outcry at Barrio, and it was a men's home for people struggling with addiction and mental health issues. So I got really close to them, and Billy Island, who, great story, comes to our Grow and Art conferences now. Uh-huh. I see him every time here at Highlands, and I'm still one of his trustees. We got very close, so I wanted to start bringing those guys to my class. So I went to Jack Graham. I said, Jack, I need to start a bus ministry. I said, if I hire a bus driver, will you give me a bus? So we put it all together, and we started busting these guys in from the inner city.
Love it.
And then I found, like, in the back of our church, there were some older senior citizens back there. So I went back, and I'm just, hey, how you guys doing? What brings you here? We started talking. This went on for weeks, and finally they're like, you know, Scott, there's a bunch of us that would like to come, but they can't get here. So we started a van ministry. We started bringing in people from all over the city. We had buses and vans.
Just like a magnet school.
Exactly. So we had these tables. We set it up as tables. Well, we started finding out none of these people had any food, really. They weren't getting good. So Aaron and I started catering dinners every night. So we would have 100-plus people going through a buffet line, sitting at these tables. And then eventually we outgrew the pastor's teaching, and I decided I wanted to teach. So when I started teaching, the class just really grew. Aaron was doing prayer. Spencer was doing worship. I was teaching. We started a podcast that still
this
you can go look
crazy
up today. It's called the Pastor's Class Podcast. So you can look. A lot of my sermons are on there. So we built this really incredible class that became a church, and basically it was our little church that was pastoring and growing and serving and
But this was started out as a Sunday school
class. Started out as six people that turned into this massive. In fact, my good friend, I still teach a bi-weekly Bible study for a guy that was an In-N-Out Burger for 51 years. I don't know if anybody in Alabama knows
In-N-Out Burger. If you don't know In-N-Out Burger, you got to go to the West Coast and get one.
In-N-Out Burger's a legend. But Ray Maldonado was a dear friend of mine. Like I said, I still teach a class for him now. But he would come to my class, and once a year I'd bring Jack Graham in to teach a class, and In-N-Out Burger would cater it for the whole church. And we would have so many people show up. It was great. Man. So anyway, during this time, I'm leading this class, doing all kinds of ministry work. I meet a lady that's in our class that has a son that's struggling with a heroin addiction.
Okay.
I started trying to help him.
The son.
The son. He was in all kinds of legal trouble. I'd hired an attorney to try to help him. And one day he missed a court appointment. I talked to him on the phone. I gave him some hard love, some tough love. And that night I got a phone call from a police officer saying he tried to kill himself. It was about at midnight. I was in my office in my home in Dallas. And I just remember just sitting down and just weeping. I was so broken by the fact that I didn't feel like I did enough to help him. So after that, I really spent about a year trying to figure out how do you help somebody struggling with addiction and mental health, starting with that one person. And I found an outpatient group that could help him and do counseling and do medication. And I started a company called Pathway Healthcare to help someone like him. And today that company has about 35,000 patients across California, Iowa, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee. But I started that company focused on the Southeast, and I headquartered it in Birmingham in 2017.
Why Birmingham?
You know, I can't tell you other than I had a draw to the Southeast. Like, the first group that we were working with actually was someone related to my mom that was in that space. Okay. So I knew the people.
You grew up here. I keep going back to that. There's so much time in Dallas that you grew up an hour north of here.
And I never wanted to come back, to be honest with you. That's a whole other story. I had such a negative childhood that I never wanted to come back to Alabama. That wasn't a part of my plan.
Sure.
Honestly, God just threw me a curveball. But I had a heart for the Southeast and rural Southeast. So all of our, most of our locations are in rural, you know, areas in Alabama and Mississippi. And so the only thing I can say is I just had a draw toward trying to do something for the same places I grew up in.
Yeah.
So we based it here, but I still didn't want to headquarter it in Birmingham. I dislike the state of Alabama so much that I would have done anything. I tried to bring it to Dallas. I tried to take it to Charleston. I did everything, but nobody could afford to leave Birmingham. It was just the cost of living was so good. Everything was here geographically.
So, oh, so you bought the company?
I bought the first one. Well, actually, I started the first one, but then I bought another one soon after
and
that.
Then kind of, and
put
then,
them together. I started one, bought one. But everything was here, and the people that I hired had been here because of the geographically where those were at. And I tried to move it, and I couldn't. And then I remember one time I was walking with Aaron. We did a lot of walking in Dallas. And I remember thinking to myself, and I couldn't even believe I was saying this, but I looked at Aaron. I'm like, maybe we should just headquarter it in Birmingham. And she's like, yeah, I've been praying about that. I think that's what we should do.
Oh, my gosh.
So at first, she was going to just come here and find a home for us, like, because I was traveling here, staying in hotels. And she was going to come here, find a place that we could stay at, and we weren't really going to move. We were going to be
have a second
part-time, half here, half there. So we bought a house. Well, at first she said, okay, what will it take for you to let me buy a house there? And I said, well, you got to find a house that's in a gated, guarded community. It has to have a good golf course. And I was trying to set criteria that I didn't even think existed.
Set the bar.
It was so high.
Yeah.
So she comes out here and she goes,
I found one.
Found one. Yeah, she calls me at the airport. I've got our house. So we buy the house, and this is 2018, and then we start a remodeling project. But this whole time, we're living in a rental house out at Shoal Creek, but I'm staying in Dallas. I still have our house in Dallas. Mm. I didn't want to come to Birmingham.
Where are your kids? What are they doing?
They were here mainly, you know, coming back to Dallas some, but I was just non-existent because I just could not get my head around coming back to Birmingham.
Really?
I couldn't face a lot of the things that I needed to face from my childhood. And it was just too painful in a lot of respects. So I was staying away. I wasn't coming that much. This is 2018. And I remember there was a time in late 18, I guess, a good friend of mine, Ron Simmons, knew that I was struggling. And Ron calls me one day and said, hey, I'm going to be driving through Birmingham. I'd like to stop and spend some time with you. And Ron stops, and we spend a whole day together just talking about stuff. And he's just a good friend of mine. And about halfway through that day, he says, you know, Scott, I got a guy that I know really well. I serve on the board with for John Maxwell's board, and he's somebody I just know you would love, and I need to introduce you to him. And I said, okay. And he said, his name's Chris Hodges. Mm. I'm like, what's Chris do?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, he's a pastor. And you know, if you live in the Baptist world, and in Dallas, you never heard of Church of the Highlands. So I'd never heard of Chris. I'd never heard of Church of the Highlands, but I'm like, man, I'd love to meet him. He said, he thinks you guys' heart will get along. So the first thing I do is when I'm driving home, I call Jack Graham. I'm like, Jack, do you know Chris Hodges? He's like, oh, yeah, I love Chris. He's a great man.
So Jack knew him.
Jack knew him. And,
at the church that you were working at.
Yeah, he knew him. And so anyway, I contacted him, and he was so gracious. And I came in and got to have coffee with him. And we just kind of bonded in a way that really only Christ could do.
Sure.
You know, like, he and I have talked about it a few times around like how we became close, and yet the time hadn't been that much. And it was just like sometimes God puts people in your life that just you automatically connect with.
But it's also this, Scott, let's just be super honest. It's also relationship. Yeah. Like if Mark were to call me and say, hey, you need to meet so-and-so.
For sure. For sure.
So like.
For sure.
That's honestly how I was called and said, hey, let's do this.
Yeah.
Because Mark thought, said, hey, you really need to sit down with Scott. Yeah. I was like, great.
Yeah.
I'll do it. Because
I was wondering why he was asking me to.
I know it was. I trust him, and you obviously trusted this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's why relationships are so important.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, that's why, like, there's got to be somebody out there that you know that I could help, and vice versa, and 100%. Things like that. So that's why, like, I love that part of, like, there's a guy that I can hit. Like, for example, there's a bank. I got a great friend of mine's a banker, and there's this young guy who's into business and real estate and all this stuff, and he's asking about all these bank questions. I said, hey, look, here's what we're going to do. I said, you're going to go. I said, go meet with Jeremy. I said, because Jeremy can answer all these questions. Jeremy's awesome. He loves Jesus, all these things. And they met this morning.
Yeah, that's
bro,
awesome.
That's awesome. I love that. It's the same thing with this situation with you and Chris.
Well, that's right. And I tell my kids this all the time. I'm like, you know, one thing you need to do in life is invest in relationships. Mm-hmm. And it's an investment. Like, you have to make sacrifices for relationships.
Do you feel like the older you get,
the smaller that pool gets.
Well, I think naturally, you know, you get a lot busier with family and kids, yeah. and maybe you don't invest in it as much. But honestly, I still do a lot. I still work hard at relationships.
Okay, let me go there. Let me go here. So your kids, 22, 19, and 17. So Spencer, Grace, and William. Do you feel like in the last 2 or 3 years you've invested more in other relationships, or was it more difficult to invest in other people when they were, let's just say, you know, 16, 14, and 12?
Ooh, because of the stage. That's a really good question.
Because I'm going to tell you something. I have a hard time right now.
Yeah. Investing in others or in
I have a hard time spending copious amounts of time with people outside of my family.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, 15, 12, 9, and a wife that coaches also.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't do stuff at night, bro.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
Like, I will eat breakfast with you. I will eat lunch with you.
Yeah.
But as far as, like, night, I'm not doing it.
I agree.
And so, like, I mean, are you...
No. Listen, that's a great question. I will tell you, like, we've been lucky in some respects because my kids have never been in sports.
Yeah.
And they've always been pretty much homeschooled. But I will tell you this. We've ate dinner together as a family their entire life.
Yeah.
Unless I'm on the road, like, we eat dinner together every night as a family. And sometimes we spend hours sitting together. So, I agree with you. Like, I will tell you, my life and my days are structured, very, very structured. Mm. It's one of the things that I do to get things done. But... I don't just hang out, bro.
No.
Like, I don't go on just guys' trips to hang out. Like, it's got to be something. Like, I went last week, and I don't say this just to make the point. I went because Dwayne Donner asked me to go to something. But, man, that's a small list of people that I'm going to take time away from my family. It's going to be somebody like Dwayne that I love and care about so much because I don't have bandwidth for it.
Me neither.
Like, I'm going to be very intentional about the times. Like, for me, it's like a trade. Like, if I'm going to spend time with you and take away from them, God better be in it.
Yeah, no like, doubt.
There better be a real reason why I'm having that time. So I do focus on that a lot. But I also, though, don't think that's mutually exclusive from investing in relationships. I think you just got to be careful not to waste time.
Yeah. No, I agree totally with you. So you moved to Birmingham. You're here mainly because of partially the business, but mainly the Lord leads you guys here.
Yeah, the Lord leads us here, but use the business to do it.
So since 18, what have you been working on from a business standpoint?
Well, mainly the healthcare company.
Pathways.
Pathway Healthcare, yeah. But I also invested in a company called LED Solutions with a dear friend of mine, Tim Petro, who's just been like a brother to me. In fact, he grew up with Robert Sherrill.
Okay. Oh,
so,
yeah,
yeah. So they're dear friends, been friends their whole life.
Where is Tim from?
Vestavia. His whole family, the Petro family. You got to know them.
There's a Petro family in Atlanta that we knew really well.
Yeah, no, they're from here.
Okay.
Great family. So I invested in a company he owns called LED Solutions. I also invested in a guy, Jonathan Shugart, who has a company called Be Charitable that, you know, I think the world, you know, nowadays I try to do things where I feel like I can help somebody, you know, and I like investing in the next generation, you know, people, young leaders, you know. In fact, one of the reasons I did that with Tim is, one, I love Tim, but his son Matthew is one of the guys, and there's a guy in there named Mackenzie Jones. Those two young folks, I love to be able to impact the next generation and try to help them. So
what is Green Chili Foods?
So Green Chili Foods is actually a company we bought a long time ago inside the family office that we still own, and they make burritos and sell them to convenience stores and HEB and
Kroger's
and those kinds of things.
Yeah. So you got the part
it's
of your,
a terrible business.
No,
by the way.
But part of your family office owns that company.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what is I'm going to pronounce this wrong? Peridot Life.
So Peridot. My daughter's birthstone is the Peridot.
Okay, so I don't even know what that is.
It's like a little green. Yeah. You know, and she's August, so it's August. So a lot of my companies are called Peridot. And Peridot Life is an insurance finance company.
Okay.
So we basically help people finance insurance. And it's been a very good business for us.
Finance insurance, what do you mean? Like
use big life insurance policies.
Okay.
So somebody that wants $100 million, you know, a billionaire family that wants $200 million of life insurance and they want to finance it outside of paying for it out of their own pocket, then we help them do that.
Okay, so let's talk through this real quick. Talk about you're talking about life insurance. Talk about it. What do you know about infinite banking and that whole process of cash value life insurance?
A lot.
Do you do that?
Yeah, we help them get the insurance all the time.
So this Perdue Life is based around cash value life insurance.
Absolutely.
And so $100 million policy, making sure there's this much life insurance and this much cash value so it doesn't mech and all that kind of stuff.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, that mech, that's a pretty good term right
there. Yeah, modified endowment contract.
Endowment contract,
yeah.
Yep. Seven pay test.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. So you know, understanding all that.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Okay. What is Opus Funding?
It's another offshoot of that company. So Perdue Life owns Opus Funding, and they do kind of separate channels in that space.
What is Opus Funding primarily focus on?
Opus Funding is actually the back office and the financing arm, and Perdue Life is the front end with the
origination. The client-facing arm.
Exactly.
I got you.
And Opus is the back side of it.
Okay. Vizon?
Vision.
Vision.
Okay. So Vision is a company that I just have helped Spencer start.
So okay.
Spencer and so Dylan Rizzo.
Dylan Rizzo. Okay, so let's talk about that. Yeah. I think this is great. Yeah. So Spencer and Dylan own, is it shirt? Or like it's a design company.
They do
screen printing.
Yeah, shirts, hats, hoodies, those
kinds
of things.
Tell
I
me
love
about
it that I'm giving them a shout out.
Tell me about that. Like, give me the rundown of what they do. And
yeah, they work exclusively for churches and ministries. And they, you know, they've tried to take, you know, most churches, you know, just have their screen printing done by just somebody they found, right? There's no real strategic reasoning to it. So
okay.
What Spencer and Dylan have tried to do is take it to a level where, no, all we do is focus on churches. We love churches. We live inside the church world. So we're going to cater to you. We're going to give you the service. We're going to give you better than everything else you give. And we're also going to give 10% of it back to you.
Wow.
And they give 10% back to ARC, basically, to help plant more churches and support more churches.
So Vision Creative, V-Z-I-O-N.
Like
Vision Creative. Okay, Vision Creative. So if there's a church out there that's looking for anything, any merch, because, I mean, here's the thing. If you're not branding something, no matter if you're a church or you're, you know, a life insurance, you got to have that. So
that's
Vision Creative. I've heard really, really good things about Dylan
They're
and Spencer.
They're doing a great job.
That's wonderful.
And I love Dylan. He's like a second son to me. So
that's great.
They've just done a great job, and I'm proud of them. I really am just trying to help them.
Yeah.
I'm trying to give them enough capital to succeed, but it's their business.
Talk to me about your three kids. So, I mean, I would answer this question if you were asking about mine. So Spencer, what is Spencer? What's he good at?
Boy, Spencer has that unique ability on the creative side and the business side.
Oh wow!
I mean, it's
that's very odd.
Very odd. Like he's very good at like his songwriting and music, but at the same time, honestly, I really mean this. He's one of the best business guys I've seen for his age. Like Spencer knows how to run a business, build a business.
Yeah.
I mean, he figures everything out. And because I force him to. I'm like,
sure.
You got to know how to do the financials. You got to know
right.
how to, everything. And he's really good at it. He's also really good at managing people. So, I mean,
I want to meet him next Sunday.
Total package.
I've never
for
met
sure.
him. Never met him.
For
I've
sure.
seen him, but I've never met him. Tell me about Grace. What's she good at?
Grace, she's my sweet little baby girl. You know, Grace is a lot like me. She's got a lot of street smarts.
Yeah.
She knows how to get around. She's the kind of person everybody wants to be around.
Mm.
She works really hard when Grace finds something that she wants to do. You know, she's just always been the person. You know, everybody's always said, man, Grace, you've just got a smile that'll change the world. And she does, you know.
Now, all three of the kids home. I'll get to William in a second. All three of the kids homeschooled. So, what does Grace do now? She's out of school, I would assume.
She's out of school, taking a gap year, trying to figure out what she's going to do next.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I love a gap year.
I know, me too. I wish I would have had one.
Man, we held all our kids. So our kids are a little older than normal, and I'm super thankful that we did because they're all going to graduate at 19. They turn 19 the fall of their senior year.
Yeah, so see, she's just catching up.
She's just catching up, yeah. Tell me about William.
William's he's 17. He's my deep thinker. Writes poetry.
Oh, wow.
You know, really a theologian. I mean, reads the Bible constantly.
Wow.
Kind of an old soul guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great kid.
Now, what does he do right now? Is he still in school?
He is.
High school? Is he homeschooling?
He's still homeschooling, yeah, through Liberty. They've done it almost always through Liberty University.
Really?
Yeah, it's been great. Been great.
Okay, so If you had to do it all again, you'd probably say, yeah, I know you'd say yes, but like, give me two major advantages you feel like your kids have had through homeschooling.
Well, I think the first is kind of, they haven't been exposed to a lot of the bad things that you can pick up in school, right? So you're not deprogramming all the time. And
that's a great way to say it.
Yeah, everybody uses that as a disadvantage. They're like, well, how do they get, you know,
social skills.
I'm like, well, you know, they've lived in the church most of their life, which, you know, it's not like they've been isolated. I mean, they they've had more dinners with adults than most kids, you know, whole life, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing. And then I think the other thing is just the closeness of our family. Yeah. Like, you know, we really love each other and we're really fiercely close. I mean, I think there's been some negatives of that sometimes we become fiercely private, but
yeah,
you know,
that's good.
We kind of get isolated if we're not careful, which God has done things in Birmingham and this church that I never thought would have done to our family. So, I mean, we could talk about that for hours, but I think the closeness, and I think just the fact that we get to direct kind of what's going into their brain and not a bunch of other people.
The hardest part about learning anything is unlearning
right
what you thought you knew.
That's exactly right.
And so when you have that option, it's great. All right. We've talked about this a little bit. In 15 seconds in business, what do you think you're good at?
Vision. I think I do a really good job of casting vision and building culture.
Yeah.
Motivating people.
So leading.
Leading.
That's great. What are you not good at?
I don't think I'm really that good at managing, you know?
What's the difference? So what's the difference? Ooh. Okay, so let's talk. What's the difference? So you just said that you feel like you're good at leading.
Yeah.
But, like, you're not good at managing.
Managing to me is being able to sit down at a table and look at all the different, you know, the numbers and the people and how this office is doing and how this is doing and how this group is doing and how do we tweak the edges and pull this in. And very few people are good at both, I think. In fact, Pastor Chris, I would think he's a rare example of somebody that's good at both.
Yeah.
He's really good at managing. Saban's be the same way. Really good at managing, but also good at leading. Like, I get really bored really fast with all the details.
Yeah.
And the details matter when you're managing.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
it's kind of like an operations is where I guess management to me falls into when I'm managing
people. The day-to-day bogs you down.
Bogs me down. I'm not good at it. And if I don't have a good number two guy, I'm not going to be successful.
Okay, great question. Great segue. How important is a number two?
For me, I think for some people, maybe not. For me, invaluable. Cannot be successful, honestly, without it.
Is a number two an obvious selection for a number one somewhere else?
Not always.
I don't think so either.
Not always. In fact, rarely, I would say. Sometimes.
I think a great number two is in some places more valuable than just a killer number one.
100%. I mean, honestly, most of the places I'm at, and they could lose me and be still okay. Hard to lose a number two and be
okay. No, I totally agree. What's the biggest mistake you feel like you've made in business?
I think sometimes I'm a little bit too overly optimistic. I think I outrun the coverage a little bit. I used to always tell people I sometimes outdream my coverage.
Yeah.
And I don't let the operations catch up. I don't let the business side of it catch up to my vision, and I kind of outrun it, you know. Wow. I think that's been harmful. I think the other thing that I've kind of been, I think a fault of mine, in fact, I'm actually going through in a small group that I'm in with HAMP. Craig Rochelle's, you know, winning the War of the Mind and talking about strongholds, you know, and how do you break those strongholds in your mind. And I think one of mine for sure is that I just have this, and it goes back to kind of what we were talking about earlier. Like for me, like if you want to put a dagger in my heart, it would be anytime I feel like I'm letting you down. Mm. Like the idea of letting someone down is like, oh.
So would you say you are a classic people pleaser?
I don't know if I'm a people pleaser, but I put everything on my shoulders. I feel like back to that weight
that I was holding up, the boulder.
Like I just feel like I have to be the one that holds up the world. And again, it's not a pride issue. It's just like, I don't want to let you down. I want to overachieve for you, whoever you is, investors, partners, constituents, employees, whoever it is. So because of that, I probably don't let people be a part of the process as much as I should.
But the good thing about that is it pushes you to work extremely hard.
It's always – that is absolutely the good part of it. I would say sometimes I overbalance it and I work myself to death when I could work smarter because I was able to let people carry the boulder with me. I think all my life, people have tried to say, and I've had people tell it to me, Scott, you need to let people carry it with you.
Delegate.
And even not delegate, but just let somebody else. It's kind of like iron sharpens iron.
Yeah,
it's like the whole, you know, have somebody with you that's helping you carry this weight of authority that you think you carry. I'm very good at delegating, but I'm very good at delegating, you know, that part that's like the management side and the get it done side. What I'm not good at delegating is all of this depends on me, you know, like how the business achieves and how it moves forward and what we accomplish.
Yeah.
I take that very personally, and probably my wife's always telling me, like, Scott, you don't have to save the world.
Yeah.
It's not all up to you.
What's your best daily habit?
My best daily habit, I would say.
Let me go back. Ask that again. What daily habit are you most proud of?
I would say the daily habit that I'm the most proud of right now is how I serve my wife.
Mm.
You know, I was talking early on when Aaron was diagnosed with cancer with Rob Hoskins, and Rob's just been a gift from the Lord to me. And I remember we were talking about it, and he was telling me a story of something that happened in his life and how someone had come to him one time and he said, was talking about serving his spouse and his wife. And he said, you know, Scott, God can't trust you with his bride until he can trust you with your bride.
Mm. Wow.
And it was right at all this time this was happening. So, you know, I've really tried my best to serve my wife in a time that's been really hard for her and our family. And I'm the most proud right now,
I
would say, of how much I've been able to support and love her during a really tough time.
All right, so I don't want to put a buzzkill in this conversation, but what is the worst habit you have right now?
The worst habit I have right now is I kind of get lost in my own mind sometimes, and I just start, you know, kind of churning out things that will become worry and stress and negative things like that. And you know, again, I'm pretty good at like countering it with the Word of God, but I still get too much in my own mind sometimes, and that creates stress and worry and things like that, which is not good. You know,
you're not gonna
fix anything by worrying about it. But you know, one of the things I do every day that I always have headsets in, but I'm not always on the phone because I have worship music pumping in my head 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
But for me, it's just like I tell people all the time, like, for me, it's just the Word of God just pouring through my brain just over and over and over again. And because my brain runs pretty fast,
man,
you know, and
you have a hard time falling asleep.
Yeah. Really hard time. And I get lost in my brain and I just, you know, I haven't had a drink since 2011, but before I was a heavy drinker.
Were you really?
And I think part of it was because I was trying to slow my brain down. Like that alcohol slowed my brain down.
Yeah.
It allowed me to relax that brain. And when I don't have it, I just run it like crazy.
Why no alcohol?
You know, it was when William was young.
Mm.
I had been a believer for a few years, and one Christmas I got a bunch of Christmas presents from friends, and they were all tequila and vodka and wine and all this stuff. And then I remember looking at William's little eyes one time, thinking to myself, man, all these people, they associate me with just drinking.
Booze.
They didn't give me any other present. They gave me alcohol because when they think of Scott Olson, they think of, man, he'll love a bottle of tequila.
Wow.
And I thought, man, is that how William's going to see me? And he was such a godly, still is a godly young man. So I remember one time Erin went out and she was taking the kids out shopping. And for some reason, I decided I was going to pour out all the alcohol in our house. So I started this process, and I was just pouring bottles of whiskey and tequila. It took me over an hour, and I was dragging bottles out to the garbage, and I was soaking wet with sweat. My hair was, the sweat was dripping, my shirt was, and I took the last bottle out there, and I came back, and I sat down on the couch, and I was completely dry. I'll never forget that day in my life. It's like all of a sudden, my clothes were dry, my hair was dry. I've never had a drink since that day.
Wow.
And honestly, like, I'm probably too hypercritical about drinking now because of all the bad I've seen, in my life.
It's a very, very polarizing subject.
It's a hard one.
It's a hard, hard subject, especially here in the state of Alabama, where, like, you know, you've got teetotalers that never drink, and then you got people that are casual drinkers, and then, you know, I mean, it's a difficult.
It's hard.
You know, I grew up as my dad was an alcoholic.
Yep.
And I did not drink alcohol until I was 38.
Wow. Gosh, and, I'd already drank a gallon. I did already drink an ocean full by
30. And then we were casual. I'd never been drunk. 44, I've never been drunk. But we casually drank for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Just,
you have never been drunk?
Mm-mm.
That's incredible.
No. Good and for you. And then about a year ago, I just stopped it again.
Yay.
And it's just like part of it, to be the God's honest truth, the part of it is the health research has come out.
Sure.
It's bad.
It's not good.
It is bad for your body. And I've even seen studies where this guy was like, hey, you remember when we were kids?
Yep.
And they used to say a glass of red wine at night was good. He says, that's a crock of crap.
Yeah, they're lying to you.
It ain't. And so I think that it's a polarizing subject, because I remember when we lived in Tennessee, and somebody that's probably going to hear this that thought this. when we were in Tennessee, we would go to parties and different gatherings and things like that. And then we heard through the grapevine that, hey, are Thomas and Jackie going to be there?
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to drink around us. And but it was all, but yes, you're right. But it was also like, what have we done and said?
Yeah.
That causes people to think that we're judging them.
I agree.
And the last thing I want is for anyone to feel uncomfortable around me in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
I 100% agree. I guess, you know, my other side of that equation would be, you know, I always weigh a lot of life in upside down.
Sure.
And I just go back to, like, you know, in Romans, you know, Apostle Paul in effect says that I would go to hell if one of my brethren knew Jesus.
Mm.
And I think about that verse because it's like, man, I would literally suffer in hell if it meant one person
yeah,
could know Jesus. And I think about it in the context of, I really, 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 really have to be convicted that drinking is good, okay, edifying, helps me, whatever, to outweigh,
yeah,
what if somebody watches me that I have influence over, somebody in this college,
yeah,
young person, that says, hey, I saw Scott drinking.
Yeah.
Why? It's no problem. I can't drink.
And because they look up to you.
Yeah.
Look up to me.
And 90% of them, you can, and I've heard people say, well, you just got to teach responsibility and all that stuff. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. But what about the one that is just predisposed because their brain is predisposed to it? Because they've got an addictive brain, because they've been on a phone their whole life, and all of a sudden the dopamine, yeah, receptors has conditioned them to be an alcoholic. What about that one person? So for me, it's like, is drinking powerfully good enough for me that one person might falter because of my drinking? And I just can't get there.
Sure.
Like, I don't get enough upside for that one downside.
Not enough upside. Love the business analogy, because
yeah,
it's true.
Not enough upside.
So back to that. What's been your hardest business?
Pathway Healthcare, for sure.
Why?
Spiritual warfare. You know, I've been trying for the last 2 years to write a book on spiritual warfare and business with my wife, because she's an author. And I just don't think people think about spiritual warfare enough. It kind of feels like a churchy thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a business thing.
No, it's real.
It's real. It's real. And that's a dark world, addiction, mental health. And, you know, that was a business that I was called to start by God. I mean, like, I left my Bible fellowship class, and if you'd have been there, I taught a message called Answering God's Call, and at the very end of it, I told the class we were leaving, and I bawled for that whole rest of the time. And then I taught 2 more weeks. I bawled both weeks. It was so
emotional. You were leaving Dallas?
When I was leaving, yeah, because I was leaving my class.
Wow.
And it was so hard for me. But, man, I've never poured more of my life into a business as I have that, and still just struggle.
Is it a profitable business?
It can be. It hasn't been for us so far. We've invested an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
It requires scale. The problem is, usually to make it profitable, you can't deliver the best care. You've got to do something less than excellent, less than what you need to do to provide help to that patient. And that's how people make money.
But you feel like that it's as much of a calling.
More of a calling than it is a business.
More
of a calling than it is a business.
At the end of the day, I know all these businesses, everything. At the end of the day, how do you, like, decompress and just relax?
I sit.
Obviously not wine.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't drink wine. I sit with my wife in the evening together just watching TV.
Yeah.
And I try to just be present with her. and get my mind away from it.
Do you like TV? Because you don't come across as a guy that likes TV.
I like you. I don't even want to tell you because you're going to laugh at me.
No, that's good.
I like Hallmark movies.
No, that's fine.
You know why? Because everything in my life is hard. That just it's seems so happy. I just, love
it's
it.
It's so easy.
They get along. Yeah. Everything turns that's out. Great. This is like perfect.
That's wonderful. See, the struggle with me is I don't like I don't like TV at all. And my wife loves it. And my kid loves it. My oldest daughter. And so they'll sit and ask, hey, you want to go watch so-and-so? And I'll go, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll be like,
not really.
Not really. But I love you so much.
Well, you're a good dad.
I'm trying. Okay, this is a really, I want to ask this question succinctly. What is, in your opinion, your plan for how you'll take your financial success and help your kids?
Mm. Wow. Well, you know, I'm trying to, you know, teach my kids about people because I think business is about people.
Totally.
So for me, I've spent a lot of time with Spencer, and as they get to the right age and their whole life, they've watched me do this, but I'm a believer in servant leadership. I'm a believer in putting people ahead of yourself. I'm a believer in being an encourager and a motivator, and all of those things is what creates a good leadership and good vision and those types of things. So for me, I've always tried to teach my kids to be encouragers, to pour into other people, to put other people before themselves. So I spend a lot of my time, you know, because I really believe that. I really believe that they've been blessed. I've given them now an ability to do things that I never had the chance to do. You know, they can go a lot of different directions, but I want them at the front of all of it to know that their mom, their dad, they've seen it, they've lived it, they've been taught it to serve people, to love people, to care for people. Because even before I was a believer, if I had to say the one thing that's been a constant in my whole life is I've always cared about people, and I've always had such a heart for helping people.
Kids do less of what we say and more of what they see.
No question.
So do you ever put Spencer or Grace or William in the car with you and say, let's go to this thing?
Those kids, since they were born, have been serving in the inner city, have been serving in ministries. In fact, there was a time where my wife wouldn't even let us get involved in a ministry unless we could bring the kids.
What about from a business perspective?
All
do you,
the time.
Do you love drinking? My kids are back in school now, but for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, we would bring them to work and
100%.
Like get them fixing food and doing all that stuff. Like, I think they need to see what dad and mom do as much as they do hear about what mom and dad do.
Well, I think I've been lucky in that respect because, you know, I've been an investor and a business guy across a bunch of different platforms, as you know. And my life, whether it be family, personal, business, it's all kind of one.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really have compartmentalized. Like, I have this 8 hours I do business and I go home and I don't do business. So their whole life has been filled with being in the car while dad's on a conference call.
Sure.
You know, this morning Spencer went with me on an appointment, and the whole time I'm like, Spencer, I want you to go with me, but I'm going to be on three conference calls on the way back. So the whole time he's listening to me interact with people and make decisions and encourage people. So they've literally grown up every day of their life seeing dad do business.
If your kid wanted to go into something that you don't know, would you send them to a buddy that does that?
Oh, absolutely.
Scott, I think that's a cheat code that, like, we have, there's a group of us investor guys that are all around my age. They're all kind of in the same stage of life, kids and stuff like that. And I would hope that if Tegan or Jonna or Georgia wants to do something that's out of the ordinary, that I've got a friend that does that thing, that I could just say, hey, go stay with so-and-so.
Oh, for sure.
Because I think that's where, because I mean, I don't know if my kids will go to college.
Yeah, mine won't.
Now, if my kids play sports, if they get a scholarship to play sports, sure. I think that's a cheat code.
You gotta go.
I think that's just cheating because you get to go for free. You get the relationships, you get all that stuff. So I think that's, I don't know. I don't know if mine don't get a scholarship to play ball.
Probably won't.
I don't know.
Well, I know ours won't. And it's
why? Why not?
I think they've seen their dad just be an entrepreneur, and they see a broken educational system. And
yeah.
if you're not going to be a doctor or lawyer or maybe teacher. An accountant or a teacher, you don't need it. And they have an entrepreneurial bent and spirit to them.
Yeah.
They've seen me. But to your point on that, I was actually having a conference call the other day with a church pastor or church planter. His name's Drew. He's planning in St. Petersburg, Florida. And he was trying to pick my brain about church planning. And I told him, listen, the one thing you need to do, I know you're going to be the spiritual leader, you're the pastor, you've got all the faith and the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Find yourself a business guy to come alongside you because you're running a business.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, I've got that guy. He said, but then his next question was, well, what would be your advice for that guy to learn and to get better? And my response to him, go find somebody to mentor him.
Yeah.
Find somebody that's already done that and done it with excellence.
And go ask those questions.
And go ask those questions. So that is the cheat.
Yeah. So financially, this I want to get technical. Financially, what tool have you leveraged for your kids' future?
Wow, that's a good question. So I would say it's all kind of just built in our businesses and the succession planning that I have.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so I own a lot of different interests in companies and businesses that all kind of reside in a bunch of holding companies mm-hmm. that ultimately will pass to them.
Do you worry? Okay, let me ask this question again. Do you have parameters set in place so that they can't do something stupid?
I've never been a big believer in that, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I have had friends of mine that were children of billionaire families that are the most responsible, good
yeah.
kids and perfect in what they do. And then I've had people that have come out of middle-class families that have been – I've just never thought it was the money that ruined them. I've always thought it was just what was inside them, what have you instilled upon them, what do they live by. So for me, I've been more focused on – again, going back to serving others and helping others, I want to raise my children and instill upon them, I think, you know, what they need to be good stewards of it, regardless of how much it is. I feel like trying to protect them is kind of like the difference. It's like PC was preaching on Sunday,
yeah.
right? It's like, am I going to make you do it, or are you going to do it because you love
Correct.
Jesus, right? Like, I can't make you be a better person.
Sure.
But I feel the same way about kids. Like, the artificial boundaries would be really to cover up for something else, right?
Yeah.
Because if they have
some inadequacy,
exactly. That's the way I've always. I'm not saying I'm
no.
Right.
I'm not saying
I'm right, but that's just the way
I don't disagree at all. I think that. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think if I'd asked that question to five different people, I'd probably get five different answers.
You would, and like right now.
That's a good answer, though.
If I had to turn over everything I have to Spencer, I would never worry about it a day in my life.
Wow, that says
ever,
a lot.
Ever.
Hard question. If you had to start over today from zero, what would you go do?
Ministry.
Zero.
Ministry.
Would you do it in a different way than traditionally is done?
I don't know. I don't think so, really. I mean, I mean, maybe if I thought about it a lot. I think because if I had to start over again and I had a blank slate, with the person I am today, I think a lot less about money and think a lot more about others.
Do you think you would think a lot less about money because you've got a lot of money now?
Could be. I mean, listen, yeah. it's a little bit of a hard thing to kind of put yourself in.
Yeah.
But I also, if you asked me that when I was 25, coming
sure.
out of being a poor kid for my whole life, maybe a different answer, I guess. I do think that I've been blessed in that all the time that I've been, the 5 years I was in ministry, and honestly, if you ask me today, like, what do I want to do for the next 5 or 6 years, it'd be full-time ministry.
Yeah.
But I've also always had the advantage of not having to be paid, which does create different dynamics.
I think God gives us all different gifts, and I think the part, of, and I'm not speaking prophecy, but like, I think the part of your mind that He created is an advantage that a lot of people don't have in ministry.
Yeah, maybe.
And I think that that's probably why it's your heart is there, but also like why He's got you there.
Yeah.
Because like you can help different people in different ways, whether it be sitting down and having coffee or there's a financial need or there's a,
yep.
or I sit here and I say this because there is a huge need in the ministry church world of financial business literacy and acumen.
No, I think that's right. It's kind of interesting, though, Thomas. I mean, I'm just getting honest and real and transparent here. I mean, I spent a lot of my life in the church, and I've done that. In fact, yeah. The reason I was part of the church planting ministry at Prestonwood when we began is because of my business acumen.
Sure.
But my heart?
Yeah.
My heart's in Woodlawn.
Yeah.
My heart's in the inner city. My heart's in the rural poverty. So it's kind of a weird balance for me. Like everything that I've done in life points you to what you just said. Mm. But I'll tell you, my heart really gets stirred by just helping somebody that, you know, is down and out or just hasn't had all the breaks. And, you know, I don't know how to marry those two. I've always struggled with that.
But I think though, that you're doing it. You're doing it with Pathways.
Oh, no, that's definitely
you're
ministry.
Doing it with, you know, you're involved with the college. You're
no question.
Involved with.
No question.
So, like.
Try to do both.
Yeah.
Well, and honestly, I am just so blessed to be where I'm at. I really never take that a day for granted.
That's great.
Like.
That's hard.
Like, I'm just telling you, like Pastor Chris and Mark, I mean, those are just two examples. I mean, they've just adopted our family.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like changed our lives in so many different ways. And honestly, I just got to say this. I mean, you know what we've been going through. I can't tell you the outpouring of love that we get from our church and from the people.
That's just wonderful.
So, I mean, I'm really, really, really extremely grateful to be in a position where I think I can help people again. Because there was a gap there from Prestonwood to maybe now where I was really struggling with where's my spot in ministry. And that, you know, I think, you know, God's timing is perfect, right? So he's just kind of setting it up, hopefully, to give me another run at helping people.
Who do you think that God wants you to help the most?
Mm.
Is there an archetype or a prototype or a type of person that you think that God wants you to help the most?
I just really believe that if you look at my life and just where I was raised and what I went through and just the course of my life, it just feels like I'd be missing an opportunity if I weren't helping people that were similarly situated. Mm. I think that's why I've always been so drawn to, you know, the inner city or the rural or just, you know, people that are poor, that just have never had a chance, that just never had somebody in their life that gave them vision and gave them hope and gave them a purpose.
Right.
And, that's why I've just always gravitated to that. Now, listen, I've been blessed, and God's equipped me to where I function equally as well in the boardroom in Manhattan.
With billionaires.
But man, I mean, if you ask me what stirs my heart, give me somebody that's in need that I can go and help solve a physical need or a financial need and at the same time deliver the hope of Christ into their life. That just fires me up.
Yeah, I love it. What does the next 5 years look like for you?
You know, I want to get Pathway Healthcare to a place where it can continue to grow and help people because I believe so much in that mission. I mean, we're reaching so many people and shining light into darkness. You know, beyond that, I want to slowly start moving more into a passive role in anything else I'm doing, starting to get Spencer more involved in things, eventually Grace more involved in things. And I really want to head back into doing more full-time lay ministry, you know.
Gotcha.
It's just what fulfills me, honestly.
Yeah.
It really is what gives me purpose, and I haven't done it in a long time, you know. I mean, the last time I did that was, you know, 2015, 16.
Prestonwood, yeah.
Really, you know. I mean, listen, again, Pastor Chris, Mark have given me the ability to get involved here, but, I mean, I was really involved there, and I'm just touching the surface. And not that I need to be involved. I don't really care what it looks like. I just know that my heart is being pulled back to that. And I'm trying not to outrun God either, right? Like, I feel
been a problem in the past.
Been a problem in the past. So I'm trying to be just patient.
Sure.
Just be patient.
That's good.
And live each day. I mean, listen, I've got an assignment right now, and it's to take care of my wife.
Absolutely.
And take care of my family. And I'm going to see that through. And there's going to be a season where we need some time, but there's also going to be a time in the future where, you know, I hope God, and I know he will, and I hope give me a chance to do what I love to do again.
Hey, this has been a great episode. 2 was wonderful. I'm so thankful. This was great. There's a lot of things in here that I think will talk to a lot of people. So Scott, thanks again for joining me.
Man, thanks for having me.
Awesome.